Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's January 21st, 2022, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 455. I'm your host, Rob Zachney, and today I'm joined by Patrick Klopik.
Hello.
Producer, Ricardo Contreras.
Yo.
And, you know, as we've predicted, it's been a quiet start to the year in games, and there's not much to talk about, but then, praise be, based Phil Spencer came through
Jesus
for us yet again.
Fucking Christ.
Now, the last we heard, based Phil was taking the revelations about a permissive culture of harassment and abuse at Activision Blizzard very seriously and examining every aspect of Microsoft's relationship with Activision. And you know, from a certain point of view, they were. Because as we learned this week, Microsoft has been working on a nice $69 billion acquisition of the mega publisher. So it turns out that the moral audit Phil implied Microsoft was undertaking was actually more of a standard pre-merger financial audit of Activision's position and susceptibility to a takeover. Patrick, talk us through this deal a little bit. Like, what is Microsoft buying here in terms of properties, and what do they stand to inherit from Activision's myriad culture and labor problems?
First of all, before I get into all the very interesting analysis, I want to point out the bravery of Rob Zachney, which is that this story has been written up in a lot of places, right? And there's a lot of ways you can go with the number 68.7. A lot of people chose, you know, not incorrectly, to say around 70 billion. Not inaccurate. It's like a nice round number. Some people chose 68.7. I want to be precise. I want the people to know like where this fits in the math. And Rob, he chose differently. He said 69 billion. And
yes.
I just want it out there that I noticed it. It was nice that you did that. I just want to go too far past without recognizing your brave stance in setting up the story. Microsoft is, this is the largest acquisition of its kind by like tenfold, right? Like I think I wanted to call it the Starfield acquisition, which it kind of is, but the Bethesda ZeniMax acquisition was like roughly $7 billion. And this is something where you just add a zero to it. They are purchasing a troubled asset, as they might call it. Arguably, the only reason they're purchasing it, could purchase it, is because it is a troubled asset. But they are buying a company that was irrelevant a couple of decades ago after, like, there was Activision was a real prominent player, you know, early in video gaming's history, and then basically was ground into dust by a series of poor decisions, was scooped up by Bobby Kotick, and he was there alongside its rise to like real video game prominence in the past 15 years or so, alongside franchises like Call of Duty, purchases like Blizzard that bring in, you know, Diablo, Overwatch, World of Warcraft. Easy to forget that Activision was also Destiny before Bungie got themselves out of like another naughty arrangement, as that studio is wont to do. It is a company that has not been in, I would say, like the highest of public esteem in terms of the games it's been making for quite a period now, like even long prior to the exposure of the like real toxic underbelly of its workplace culture. One then which Call of Duty was really on the wane until Warzone came along and they were able to really capitalize on the rise of the battle royale genre. Like Warzone, I think inarguably could say like essentially saved Call of Duty as a franchise, as the single player games have really petered out in terms of cultural relevance, like sales driver. Like, does anyone remember that Vanguard came out a couple of months ago? Like, I don't.
Who?
And then alongside that, you have a studio like Blizzard, who, again, absent knowledge of what was going on as a workplace, is like basically incapable of shipping products. Like, the moment you have to call in Rod Ferguson, the person who was brought in to tell Ken Levine, like, here, we're going to crack some knuckles and we're going to ship a fucking game. Like, that's what I'm here to do. He did that for Gears of War. He did it for BioShock. And when you hire Rod Ferguson, you're bringing in someone to be like, hey, this game looks like it's not coming out for 5 to 6 years. How about two? And let's turn this into a shippable product. Just a company like in a really weird place as it tried to figure out how to position itself for the future. And alongside that comes, a report over the last summer by the state of California, you know, having one of their divisions, the California Department of Fair Housing, Employment and Housing, filing a lawsuit against the company following a 2-year investigation, more or less exposing a horrifying workplace culture and environment in which accusations of harassment, assault, day-to-day shittiness, like just an awful place to work. And by all accounts, very little has been done to try and address those issues. And in fact, bolstered by reporting at places like the Wall Street Journal, that rock goes all the way to the top. It is not simply a matter of ignorance, but actually active practitioning and malice on the part of its current CEO, Bobby Kotick, both participating in that culture, facilitating that culture, and ignoring the things that would come to light. And so you have all this happening. And then by all accounts, there was a follow-up piece in both Bloomberg and Wall Street, in the Wall Street Journal, filling out some of the backstory here, which is that it sounds like Kotick had a real moment of panic. Like, you know, as we were speculating, you know, on our side, like, hey, you know, really feels like this would be an opportunity for the like board of directors, the slimy, like self-appointed, you know, Kotick approved board of directors to just kind of move on from this guy. The stock was sliding. Games are getting delayed, like pushed out, like, you know, year and a half. You know, maybe this, you know, if the accusations weren't enough, maybe the financial slide is actually what's going to be what gets them. And to some degree, who cares? You know, alongside this, you have people doing work stoppages at Raven Software over how the QA team were like unceremoniously laid off as contractors. While like a couple of people were brought in full time, bunch of people were just laid off. There's a talk of unionization. There's like formal organizing happening inside and outside of the company. You have people petitioning, taking, you know, essentially striking. You have I think at this point, almost $400,000 strike fund that is currently ongoing to help the folks that are striking at Raven Software. And that essentially leads to this opportunity where Microsoft seems to, like the back-end reporting is like Microsoft seems to recognize, shit, they're fucked. if there was a time to purchase them and there's probably no one else who could do it, it's us. They got Phil Spencer on the, you know, to get on the phone. I was not aware, until this moment, I did not realize that Phil Spencer was this hands-on with sort of like the negotiating accounting stuff. Like the reporting has suggested he personally negotiated, you know, the ZeniMax acquisition. He personally negotiated this acquisition. He personally negotiated the Minecraft acquisition. You know, obviously like he's good at wearing t-shirts and is really good at PR spin and has done I think, decent job of like navigating Xbox out of a crisis over the last decade to getting a little more relevant again. But I was struck by, I didn't realize how hands-on Spencer was in all this stuff. So anyway, like getting to the end of all this is, you know, Microsoft essentially offers Activision a pretty reasonable, though not mind-blowing, deal based on what the company is currently valued at, what the shares are currently valued at. And Activision, after seeing if Facebook or EA would be interested in finding absolutely no suitors, Microsoft seemed to get what exactly they wanted, which is like, this company needs an out. We're going to give them a little bit of money. We're going to give the golden parachute that everyone gets. And then we're going to acquire an enormous roster of intellectual property and a shitload of studios and talent that could be leveraged to probably not do a Call of Duty treadmill ad infinitum. And so that's where we leave us. Like now, you know, we can get into the antitrust stuff and the regulators. The if nothing was to happen, the deal could close, I think, as soon as this summer. I suspect it will take longer and get drawn out and will still happen, but that we may not know much more until early next year. That I think that brings us to this moment, this podcast transition.
Yeah. So to that, I think one of the other, so there was some weird timing around this as well, which is that like literally couple hours after the covers were lifted on this deal, the head of the Department of Justice's antitrust division, Jonathan Cantor, and
yeah, same day, I think, yes,
the head of the I think she's the head of the FTC right now, Lina Khan, held a press conference where they discussed the new guidelines they are developing for the enforcement around antitrust and merger approval, namely that we might finally have some again. So this may actually end up being kind of important around this merger. So let's take a minute to lay some groundwork. The first thing to say is that just about all of us talking about this issue or probably listening to this podcast are entitled to a lot of cynicism about this stuff because we have only ever seen these ideas defanged or manipulated to favor like corporate giants and huge investment groups.
When we grew up during the defanging, right? Like, yeah. So we were too young to truly, we lived through the Microsoft Internet Explorer antitrust stuff. But like most of us were like, you know, 10 young teens, like not actually processing like what was going on as the government, like even the Clinton administration was like, ah, yeah, this is pretty bad, huh? Probably should do something about
that. We finally have to do something about this. Right. And so like that, like all of us have grown up, like antitrust has not even been a speed bump for companies engaging in like anti-competitive practices or like buying their rivals. We've not, like none of us like in our age bracket have like ever seen these ideas applied forcefully at all. But there is a history around this where like federal regulation and oversight spent literally decades kind of frustrating the consolidation of industries into monopolies and narrow oligopolies. And ideally, that was an attempt to protect citizens and small businesses along the way. Real quick, antitrust is an archaic term. It's how like we talk about competition law in the U.S., but like the trusts of the Gilded Age that needed to be broken up don't exist anymore. So it's like a term that existed and came into like common parlance in this one like historical context. But most of what we're talking about is like regulations around preventing anti-competitive business practices. And that last part is kind of key because mergers like this have to be approved to and satisfy some conditions that the merger itself will not concede an undue amount of market power or create an anti-competitive environment in an industry. The way this has always worked in the past is business kind of gets to spin you a story about like how good the merger is going to be. And regulators would be like, yeah, that does sound pretty good. And that's it. So like famously. Well,
and notice you're seeing this play out in real time. You see Kotick giving very friendly interviews to places like VentureBeat. You're seeing Spencer, who even folks like I think like Gene Parker over at the Washington Post, like, did a good interview with him. At the end of the day, Spencer is the king of spin. I will say he's as personal in real life as he is like in these calls, even in like non-official spaces. Like he still comes across as that guy, but he's very good at that part. So like that's part of what's happening here in these interviews is what Rob is speaking to is like, how do you start greasing the wheels, addressing these antitrust questions, these monopoly questions before the actual like, gears of government begin moving? Because that takes more time after these announcements happen.
Right. So the thing is, one of the things that, so undoubtedly this is a huge deal. But one of the first like arguments against the FTC raising any flags is all is that, well, you know, even after this deal, Microsoft is still just the third largest, gaming firm in the world. So the thing is, that is the argument Microsoft are making themselves. I don't feel under an obligation to regurgitate it because I don't think, like, I'm sure Microsoft wants that standard. I'm less convinced that it's relevant because regulators don't necessarily measure mergers by their place within, like, enormous economic sectors. Regulators can separate, like, gaming writ large from PC and console retail games. What is relevant is that even after this merger, there's probably a case to be made that even like games remain a really competitive space, like even after an acquisition like this. And I think that's probably the strongest case they will have to make to get this merger through. But there's a couple other factors, because the thing that has people really excited about this, of course, is, hey, what's this mean for Game Pass? Just imagine.
Is the consolidation. It's the same, you know, look, I don't think Disney should be able to buy Fox. Do I want X-Men and Fantastic Four in the MCU? I sure do. But like that, you gotta try and think critically about those two things you're saying as you unpack the like fanboy, like game fan part. Like, yeah, you know what? When Phil Spencer in his interview with the Washington Post says like, man, I think we own Hexen now. And I'm like, you do. You know what I like? Hexen and Heretic. It's like, that is calculated. That is weaponizing your fandom and like love for different games and properties for you to then your brains to start going, well, I mean, if he's name dropping Hexen, like how much bad could this do?
So, and that's the thing, right? Like right now, like the idea is, well, Game Pass is already awesome. With all the potential Activision stuff like flooding into that system, Game Pass becomes an even more ridiculously good deal for like what you're paying per month. And yes, there's that potential that Microsoft would start resurfacing some of these old franchises and maybe letting some studios and creators that have just been sort of shackled to churning for Call of Duty do some other stuff.
Hey, Raven, you made Heretic 2. People like Patrick Klepek specifically loved Heretic 2. Wouldn't you love to make a Heretic 3 just for him?
And so, yeah, that's where the excitement comes from, right? But at the same time, I think Game Pass is one of those things that probably looks interesting to regulators because it's also a really powerful platform that might in itself already be tipping toward being anti-competitive. And one of the things that can make something anti-competitive is like, if you have access to limitless like pools of capital and your strategy is basically, we are going to absorb massive losses that our competition couldn't possibly sustain until they're dead. And then like, we are sort of the last player on the board. That's like definitional, like that's the definition of like an anti-competitive practice, right? It has been permitted.
Sony lost what, 20 billion in valuation as a result of this news, which should be a red flag of like, now, you know, that can also be, you know, investors and shareholders are finicky that don't act rationally. But I do think you could like add that to a series of red flags that is like, if a company over a potential sale can lose, you know, a fourth of the size of this deal just because it might happen, is maybe a reason to think, huh, like what does this broadly say about where this industry is trending?
And certainly I think this move also like probably heightens the odds of it trending toward further consolidation, right? Like once a deal like this goes through, and you already see that there's a lot of people sort of arguing that well, surely the writing is on the wall for operations the scale of EA or Ubisoft, right? Mm. Companies that
or
are like
Capcom. Like Capcom, only $3.5 billion. Like that's just
easy pickup. Yeah. And you'd argue like to compete with what Microsoft is building, there's going to be firms that like have to start contemplating acquisitions like that. But the idea that like if Game Pass is operating at a loss and it's being bolstered by the subscription is basically being bolstered by just the buckets of money that Microsoft can inject from other lines of business, that in itself might be a problem in a way it didn't used to be. Companies like Uber got away with a lot because regulators did look the other way on a lot of the stuff about like letting a company come into a space connected to like venture capital money and just grind little taxi firms into the ground that like are operating on a daily like profit and loss basis.
Well, I think it's also the matter of like the culture and the climate and the attitude toward the thing that it's involved, right? Like who likes taxis, right? And it's like, right. Oh, I can order one from my phone. That sounds great. Why would we stand in the way of that? And I think that's like that's where like the weird sort of like culture intersection that is interesting here. Where like I don't think even a more left-leaning aggressive FTC is going to care that much about the entertainment industry consolidation. I disagree with that like notion. I think they should care, but because this is coming from Microsoft, I think like that's going to invite an extra layer of scrutiny that it wouldn't if Netflix had decided to buy Activision. Like, I don't know that there's a whole lot of hand-wringing going right. on about that. But because it's Microsoft, it's their own history. It's the fact that the FTC is now saying, we need to take this more seriously. Even if you ultimately fall on the side of this is probably okay and isn't, like, significantly tipping the balance of power, you have to run it through the ringer, or you should run it through the ringer, if only to show that you're doing the work and that other firms should be thinking twice about, you know, to how much scrutiny do you want to go through to get this?
And I mean, crucially, we're talking about like it being Microsoft and like Xbox and Game Pass as being examples of like platform capitalism. Lena Khan sort of made her name and rose to prominence on the backs of an analysis she conducted of the FTC's treatment of Amazon. And it was like, it is wild how important and influential this thing she wrote for the Yale Law Journal ends up being, Amazon's Antitrust Paradox. It's a surprisingly accessible read. But her entire framework there is that the consumer welfare standard and sort of the framework that was applied to protecting competition didn't really adapt well to the like platform capitalism models being adopted by Amazon and would require a rethink. And so like specifically the people who are sort of running the show right now are very hip to the challenges posed by things like Microsoft, by the various services and platforms it can run. And so like, I think that you'd also argue that it's kind of bad timing too, because if there were like, if you wanted to start like running test cases to see how you're going to apply this, this one might also be of interest to regulators. My suspicion is like, I am like, you know, I open this by saying we have right to be cynical. I find it hard not to be cynical that when push comes to shove, deals still go through. People who've worked in antitrust around agriculture have sort of found that the Biden administration talked a good game. But the USDA, which is led by a really pro big ag, Secretary Tom Vilsack, ultimately, they don't give a shit what's happening to smaller agriculture operations. They are continuing to sort of protect and promote the interests of major ag firms. That could still happen here, but it certainly indicates that like both DOJ and the FTC are a little more savvy about how the tech giants that we deal with today gained all their market power, and they might be looking to apply a more aggressive standard moving forward. And just to give you a quick, if you haven't, dig up a series on antitrust Planet Money did like a couple years ago, as I think as Lena Khan was coming to prominence. But basically, they sort of cover the entire history from the breakup of Standard Oil through to Amazon. Really good series that explains a lot of this stuff. But one of my favorite details was that in the 60s, they were so pro-competition that they started preventing small local mergers on the grounds of being anti-competitive. Like as recently as 1966, Vons Grocery in LA wanted to merge with another grocery chain. And I think it went to the Supreme Court and they swooped in and said, no, that's anti-competitive because after this merger, you'd have 7.5% of the Los Angeles area grocery market. Like in the 60s and 70s, like the treatment of this stuff bordered on fanatical in places, which probably helped open the door for Robert Bork's like toothless, like consumer welfare standard, which was basically that, hey, as long as prices don't go up, the government has no grounds to complain about what's going to happen. But so like there's this other model that like just predates us where you had the government sort of presuming that if two companies were proposing a merger, they were up to no good and they would just sort of knock your merger over. And so like by that standard, I suspect this deal will be dead in the water, right?
They might not have even done it, right? Like this, right. If that was the presumption, that level of scrutiny on that scale of acquisition, this wouldn't have gone. They would have waited until Activision went under, right? Like you know that Activision would be selling individual pieces, right? Like, okay, fine, you can't buy Activision Blizzard. Do you want to buy Blizzard? You know what I mean? Like those are the sort of conversations that would have happened as in that kind of environment. But I think you see, you know, Activision, you know, Microsoft publicly projecting like, hey, this isn't going to close for like a year plus, you know, like that, all of that seems to anticipate and invite that like, hey, this is going to get run through the ringer. We still anticipate it's going to happen, but that there at least is going to be some sort of comb that goes through it. But the fact that it even is proposed at the scale that it was, you know, even if it is an undervaluation of like where Activision might have wanted to sell in a different environment, the fact that it's even being proposed at all suggests that they expect it will happen. And that itself is an indictment of the process as it currently exists.
Well, it's interesting that there was some indication that, like, yeah, Kodak was desperate to sell, not to Microsoft though. He wanted to, like, maybe someone else to come in, right? The other thing is Microsoft is on the hook for a $3 billion fee if the deal falls apart for any reason.
What I read was like that's significantly larger than how this usually, like, it's usually like
it's a large billion insurance policy.
So that's quite a bit more than which I guess would project some measure of confidence that it's going to happen.
Or less confidence on Activision's part, where like Microsoft's sure. Like, we got this, I'm confident of it. And Activision is like, we are less sure. So let's say 3 billion. So I think there's cause to like, certainly think that this deal is going to enter a like very different regulatory environment than existed just a year ago. Like, the Disney Fox merger is kind of an example of like, would that go through today? Increasing evidence that might not have, right? That like that,
or it would have come with like the caveats, right? Like there would have been carve outs, like there would have been I think like there are worlds in which like there are gradations of how something like this plays out, where maybe it is like the acquisition still goes through, like Disney is able to claw, you know, their Marvel properties back, but hey, you can't keep Fox Search. You know what I mean? Like, well, there are ways the carved out.
Right now is probably like under the old regime, the carve outs were often laughable, right? Like the T-Mobile Sprint merger, which was clearly like, we're going to go from four major wireless carriers to three, and that's not anti-competitive. Well, don't worry. You're going to have a fourth major wireless carrier, Dish Network. Like that was their solution. Was like, yeah, you're losing T-Mobile, but Dish Network will be a perfectly viable carrier, even though there's no history of that organization like doing that shit.
And if I remember that part of that, one of the public arguments I heard in favor of like why you should allow that merger to occur was because, well, AT&T and Verizon are too big. Unless these two team up, they're not big enough to take on the other carriers. Like, well, that's not, then that means we fucked up before. That's not an argument to let the consolidation continue. It's like, well, we've got two kaiju And they're fighting, you know, let them fight, I guess. But it turns out they're holding hands and doing things together. We get all these other kaiju together and we stack them on top of one another. We can make our own one to fight them. It's like, no, you're just admitting that you fucked up already. And the solution to that is to let the bad thing keep happening and hope it works out differently.
Well, and I think that's, and I think the last point I'll make here too is, I think genuinely, I think one of the things that may have changed the environment around this a little bit is that we're in the middle of this moment where it's very clear that it's clear in some sectors that corporate consolidation has led to a lot of the inflation we're seeing, that like every single cost that companies are like being are confronting right now, they're able to seamlessly pass on to customers. Mm-hmm. They're also, I think Khan was on C-SPAN the other day sort of arguing that inflation is also really good cover for companies just to raise prices, be like, you know, price of a brick went up. Sorry.
And then the people doing, you know, the other, it's like, oh, well, you're raising your price. Well, yeah, inflation is bad for us as well. I guess we're up, go up 25 cents.
And that's the other thing is like in all these places where you've seen like monopolies haven't formed, but instead you have a few firms with like massive amounts of market power, they clearly signal to each other and they do not compete.
That's been like one of the huge criticisms of like the airline markets, mm-hmm. right? Like when you like, hey, we're going to take the heat, we're going to charge people to put a bag on. And like, then all of a sudden 5 years later, everyone's done it. And it's like, sure. It's not, you know, they didn't all get in a room together and explain that's how they were going to explicitly raise prices on everybody. But like, if everyone does it, you know, slowly over time, you're able to diffuse the government's ability to scrutinize it.
And I think that,
especially if they're not paying attention.
I think that goes to like, so Game Pass is a really good deal right now. Like going back to like, what's Microsoft doing here? Like, is he truly based, Phil, just bringing all the games and franchises to the people for a low monthly fee? And I think you have to look at it as like, what could happen in 10 years? And maybe under different leadership, right? Like people who are, I think like if you scratch Phil Spencer, you still find like a games person underneath that surface.
I genuinely do think he cares. It's possible that he cares, does want to do right by X, Y, and Z, and can also be participating in things on a scale that should be considered dangerous and requires scrutiny.
Well, and companies often end up passing on like huge lines of business to people who don't give a shit about the product,
right.
who are basically
right.
just like finance people where every product is basically a commodity to get more money. And everything should be regarded as like a financial tool or instrument to like realize greater returns. So I think like you have to look at, so what might Microsoft do with like a massive stable of games all under their like Xbox Game Pass brand. And then you run the clock forward in 10 years. There's certainly reason to be concerned that like the deal will be less good, that the offerings found there might not be as robust, because let's be real. I think one of the reasons that Game Pass has been so cool is that Game Pass is getting a lot of buy-in and cooperation from developers who are finding it impossible to compete with the mega franchises at the top of the games industry, and then the extremely low barrier to entry at the bottom, right? Like the middle of the game sector is
becoming, how do you get noticed, right?
Yeah.
And so in some ways, Game Pass has one of the most lucrative places to be in video games 10, 15 years ago was Steam's front page, right? You get there, you're golden, baby. Like your game is like, you're rich, your game's going to sell well, people are going to buy it. And then Steam opened the floodgates in various ways and for reasons good and bad, and that disappeared. Now it's much more difficult, to just get noticed. And I think in some ways you can look at Game Pass like in its current state as sort of like a front page. Like you get in there, you have a deal with Microsoft that maybe covers some of your development budget, but it's also awareness. We will be in a manageable queue in which it's not a giant storefront full of tens of thousands, millions of things. It is a smaller curated selection of things in which we know there are going to be eyeballs and people are going to have a much lower barrier to, I'm going to try this thing. And like, that just doesn't exist in many places right now, it is very difficult to get noticed. And like the ways of gaining attention are far less simple than they used to be of make game, hire PR person, you know, get noticed, game is good, hit game. You know, like it's just so much more complicated these days. And Game Pass is just like one of those avenues that at least ensures I think 25 million is the number on Game Pass right now. 25 million people, to I have to imagine people using Game Pass are like pretty active. Like I would my guess is that like that the number of active Game Pass users is extraordinarily high compared to other services. That's a really attractive offer, especially for the in combination with the rising budgets of even the smallest of games.
But the flip side is that is it also conditioning gamers to not buy games? Right. Like there's concern around that. Like what's the conversion rate on a game that goes to Game Pass? And there's also like in 10 years, you have to contemplate the possibility that Game Pass is so popular, especially because it exists on two platforms, that Microsoft, they don't own the PC, and like PC diehards would be like, absolutely not. It's an open platform. But like Microsoft, by virtue of running the fucking operating system, occupies a really nice position on PC where they can like put things in front of you in a way that other companies can't. But you'd sort of see in like 10 years that like the presence of Game Pass has distorted the economics of like retail game sales. In ways that like might be of some concern, both in terms of like what choices are available to consumers, and then just in terms of like how viable it is to make games as a business. And then I think the other thing you have to look out for is if it turns into a situation where Microsoft has a great deal of control over both sides of this, where they're dictating the price of licensing games for Game Pass, and they are dictating the price to consumers as to what Game Pass costs. Again, tremendous amount of market power that might be of some concern, right? Like, do people still feel good about their Netflix sub at this point? Doesn't seem like it. They just announced a rate hike again.
But you know what? I upgraded that thing to 4K and then I've forgotten about it for 3 months. So you got me. Also, my daughter watches that Baby Shark thing on Netflix Kids 3 times a day.
What do you mean?
So, oh, God. What?
Isn't it just a video
shark thing? No, oh my God, Rob. I mean, there's no reason for you to know this, but like Baby Shark and Pink Fong, which that'll make sense to all the people that know what I'm talking about, is a whole industrial complex. Like it is, there is a Pink Fong. Pink Fong is this little pink little fox that was the corporate branding of the company that did the Baby Shark song, but has now become like their mascot and is part of the Pink Fong extended universe. And oh no, buddy.
I absolutely thought you said Bing Bong, which is a very different thing.
Yeah, very different. No, Pink Fong, which is how the mascot introduces itself and the songs. Yeah, I'm stuck. You know, I mean, Netflix has put they pay lots of money for adult shows, but you want to see like shows updated like twice a day, like go to the kids section. Like there is so much money in their kids stuff. It's wild. Anyway, I don't know what point I interrupted. I just all of a sudden had to say something.
No, you were just saying that that you are a pay pig for Netflix.
I am. Yes. Jesus. That and Disney Plus. Sorry. That's just part of, that's my help me, my family is what's the fucking drill candles.
Well, so I scrapped Netflix.
Everything else I either share a login or I only like I signed up for Showtime, paid my $8, watched Yellow Jackets, and you know what I did? Immediately canceled Showtime because like I got to watch a whole season of a show, loved it. Got way more than $8 out of it. And it's like, all right, when Yellow Jacket season 2 happens a year from now, you know what I'll do? Hopefully borrow a login, but also maybe pay $8 to watch another month of Yellow Jackets.
Yeah. So like, I think like right now, the lens through which I view Game Pass is like, it is not being something built or having more things added to it as an act of corporate largesse. You have to think about like, what might a greedy company with a history of abusing its position for anti-competitive practices, which it does. Like, this is part of Microsoft's DNA, right? It's like Microsoft might as well have a big, like, no longer under federal consent decree, like banner.
That's all these companies, though, right? Like, that is the natural ascent of a large corporation is to, you know, I was reading an analysis of this deal, and, you know, one thing sometimes people point to is like, well, you know, I mean, Microsoft could have stomped out Google and they didn't. It's like, well, you know why they didn't? Because they were still fucking scared shitless that if they did anything to interfere with a company like Google, which they absolutely could have stomped out if they wanted to or acquired and just like made part of the Microsoft empire. They didn't because they were worried that the government would come knocking again. And like, that's what you, those are the ripple effects you get by proper enforcement and really just scare tactics, is that then, you know, it's not about convincing corporations to act appropriately. It's about making them too scared to do it. And you do that through proper, stricter, more stringent regulation. And then you get, you know, Google is now bad, but they were good for a time, right? Like, they sat along web crawler and whatever. And like, the notion is that you're not going to stop big corporations from being bad, but you can let smaller companies flourish and be competitive and allow themselves the dream of being the big shitty corporation. The problem now is like, it's hard to imagine like a Google emerging even now, because that came out of the shadow of the 90s antitrust, and we don't even have that shadow.
Right. Now you have a Google, Amazon, and Microsoft trifecta like crushing any sort of opposition.
You know what? There was a line that really kind of, it was a good line by Spencer. I don't have it right in front of me, but the paraphrase was, you know, video games is really competitive. And the evidence that it's competitive is you have companies like Facebook, you know, / Meta, Amazon, Netflix, Apple. They're interested in video games. They want to make video games, but they're tech companies. Like, do you want them making your video games? Microsoft, now granted, 25 years ago, we weren't into video games and we were one of the people, but now we are video games. If you wanted anyone to acquire Activision Blizzard, because it was going to happen, you want it to be us, Papa Microsoft. I love Hexen, Patrick. Well,
and there's something very funny.
And that's
about
a really insidious fucking pitch. Like, you know, that's one that like I could sit here and be like, he's not wrong. But that's also, there's a real, I don't, you know, once you sit with it, it doesn't feel good. Even it can have a point and also be like,
well, in the whole, like
at the same time,
they'd only be the third largest games company. Yeah. Except they're Microsoft. They're not a games company. Right? Idiot. Like that's the area. I think the whole like this, oh, we're just a small little baby games company that owns fucking Windows and Office and a ton of like server infrastructure and like business IT services.
A $70 billion acquisition is I think I saw 2 to 3% of their entire valuation, which is like a $3 trillion company.
Jesus Christ.
So, you know, I might be getting the numbers. I might get the evaluation, but like it's not quite a rounding error, but it's not much bigger.
Well, and so the other thing is, like, I think where this sort of ties back into labor as well is that, like, the larger a firm gets, the more control they have over prices regardless, the less competition they face, the more they can feel free to reduce capacity. And that means things like forcing people to do more work for less. It also means things like just eliminating a lot of the offerings you traditionally sort of offer as products, because you no longer need to compete with as many people. And I'm sort of like reminded of the fact that, like, you know, brought up Vons a little bit earlier. So in the 60s, you know, keeping the foot firmly planted on the throat of these little like local regional chains that are like, we want to like merge and like, and get a little more like local market power. And I was like, well, what's Vons done lately? And I just remembered, oh yeah, that's right. They fired all their union workforce in the last year, because Vons is huge now. Like Vons like has been sort of liberated from that framework. They've become an enormous like grocery chain in California, and like with the help of Prop 22, they're able to sort of just dictate at will new terms of employment. And I think this is the other like thing to sort of look out for is the fact that we do know for a fact that for ages there was the Blizzard tax, for Blizzard being such a prestigious company to work for that people would like accept far less in terms of pay and benefits, just in order to like work at Willy Wonka's like candy factory. And if Willy Wonka was going to be mean to you or harass you routinely, well, actually, Willy Wonka was mean. That's the other thing is Willy Wonka should have had like regulators up his ass the entire time.
Kids died on that tour.
Willy Wonka, by all accounts, like enslaved a population.
No, jail for Willy Wonka, to be clear. But I think like it gets even more. It gets even tougher now when like so many of the studios that someone could like move laterally to now ultimately answer to the same company. Like that would also like long-term maybe distort the marketplace and probably does make it more of a priority that it would like, Patrick, I'm curious your take. I think your view was gut level. This probably makes the road to effective union representation at the currently Activision Blizzard King Studios harder. And I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah, I mean, look, Bobby was going to get the golden parachute no matter what. Like the deck was, he had a board of directors that they all like him, have worked with him. Like he was never going to get, it was always a far-fetched, I think, or unlikely that he was going to get pushed out. And so he was always going to get some sort of money one way or another if he was going to leave. And so if you're looking for silver linings in all of this, it's that, you know, hopefully like he's made all the private and public signals are that he will be gone when this deal closes and he will take his money and go buy his mega yacht and do what he, and probably start an esports organization. And that's good. That is, you know, it's that is a good. He should not be in charge of that company. He should not be leading whatever it does into the future. And hopefully, if that is more than just personal satisfaction to the people he has made miserable at the company he has operated for, you know, the last 20 years or so. But, you know, I've expressed pessimism that I think this would naturally, and I think this is a natural reaction if you work at that company, that this is going to sort of like let out some of the oxygen in the balloon. Like this is going to like release some of the tension, and that the notion that like we all need to like then charge around unionization and be organizing is going to feel less necessary because, well, maybe things will be better over there, and things probably will be better because it sounds like it couldn't have been worse. And I haven't done all the reporting on like how Microsoft treats its individual studios, but, so I can't say it's going to be better, but I do think it's probably fairly confident that I say it's not going to be worse. And so if this can be a fresh start for their culture as an organization, like that's good. I do hope that they continue to do that sort of organizing because if it calls for accountability. If that does not result in a union, that was always sort of a long shot anyway. But the idea of giving that up right as you're being handed over to a bigger company that will be able to, that could turn the screws even harder than the last one if they chose to. I hope they continue organizing. I hope they continue trying to group together in whatever form that takes because that is useful to them. That is useful to the industry. And like that comes alongside there was to bring this to a close, I published two blogs on the site today that were sort of little pieces extracted from the Game Developers Conference, which is coming back in person / virtual next month in March in San Francisco. They do, as part of the GDC, they do like a survey of like several thousand industry professionals to try and get a snapshot of what people are thinking. And it was like on one hand, developers think crypto sucks shit, which is good, but also not super surprising. And the other is that in the 10 years they've been asking the question about unionization, the support to unionize is an all-time high of 55%. Only 18% believe that unionization will actually happen, which I don't think is like an unreasonable, like if you're pragmatically answering, like I would probably fall on that 18%, but I'd also fall on the 55% that thinks that it should. And I think if you're taking as sort of as dispiriting as a lot of this can be, especially if you were hopeful that as bad as things were at Activision, that maybe this was a catalyst for like meaningful change that could ripple out to the rest of the industry. Yeah, maybe it doesn't result in a union at that studio or those studios. But boy, if you think back even just 2 years ago, the notion that we are now at a place where you have active members of studios striking, publicly organizing, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for a strike fund, that is change. Like it's all on the path to, I don't know that it's all fixed, but I do take those as really encouraging signs. And hopefully those people who stay and move on to Microsoft whenever that closes are able to keep that fire lit when they make it over there as well.
I think one thing is in a way I understand where the hope that things will be better comes from. And I think to your point, it probably will be, right? Like there's a lot of people who really enjoy working at big, boring companies with generous packages and decent workplace conduct rules and enforcement, right? And a decent culture. I don't know, by the way, I don't know, like Microsoft's a huge company. I don't know right. like what it's like to work there. Like I know enough people at EA that I'm like, that when I think of like people who like working at kind of boring shambolic companies that have like good pay and decent benefits, EA is like right there at the top of the list where it's like, are you passionate about everything you do? No. Is it fine? And am I well taken care of? Yeah, it ain't bad. But I think even if you were to say like the people at Activision and Kodak have been like model citizens, right? And like run a really like ethical, compassionate company. Kodak stands to walk away from this with like $293 million. $293 million from this deal going through. And the thing that gets like you need a union to protect yourself from all these like abuses, yes. But also I feel like you need a union to stop like having your shit stolen so like nakedly in public, right? By like the people who run these companies. Like the amount of like excess value created by the people who worked on Activision games across these last decades is incalculable. For these folks, and they are never going to see that, right? Like these are all folks who are going to be going like approaching retirement or something with the same concerns and worries that, you know, anyone will. Meanwhile, like the people who basically dictated what rates were and what benefits were, they are all going to be able to exit this industry with robber baron fortunes because the wealth didn't need to be shared. And so like, even if Microsoft brings a cultural house cleaning, to Activision, it does not change the fact that, as a rule, the people who build these fortunes for like the managerial class and the ownership class don't ever see a payday from it. And I think this acquisition kind of puts a period on that, where the arch villain of Activision is probably going to walk away with the bags of cash.
Yeah.
And nothing but like a bad reputation to follow him around. But $300 million will be quite the comfort.
Nice pillow.
You know, like bad reputation from us. Like when he has no shit about us. You know what I mean? Like
his peers will regard him as enormously successful.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
And with that, we will take a quick break and then we'll get back to talking about Well, just the games and less the games industry, I think, at that point. Be right back. And we're back. So, Patrick, you have been playing a game that I've seen some people posting about, Nobody Saves the World, which feels apropos, I suppose. But, Patrick, what is it? What is it as a game as opposed to an epitaph for our times?
So I actually talked about this briefly when Microsoft did their last like demo showcase for a bunch of independent games. So Nobody Saves the World is... the new game from Drinkbox Studios, the folks who did Guacamelee, which were like really stylized Metroidvania style games. I really liked the first one, didn't really care for the second one, but in general have liked what that studio has put out. And Nobody Saves the World is a top-down action game in which the kind of you get plopped into a world where you are this like kind of bland looking nobody, and you stumble upon a wizard apprentice who is a complete prick, and you just he's wondering why like this main wizard has disappeared right as the world is like being plunged into darkness and there are monsters everywhere, and you find like this wand that allows you to take the forms of different things. And so this is a game in which you are constantly switching between different forms that allow you to turn into everything from a rat to a I'm trying to think what I've got. A rat, a horse, an archer, a soldier, a slug, and what's the one I just unlocked was a not a mermaid. It's kind of like a mermaid. I think it might be listed as a mermaid, but a very terrifying looking more like a siren, I guess, but possibly, but with an aquatic creature, but with the teeth of Baraka from Mortal Kombat is, I guess, what I would describe the aesthetic. Right. And you can at any time switch between any of these creatures, these like forms as you unlock them. They all have wildly different abilities. So it goes from the rat, which is the one that you sort of like start with the first form, it has this poison attack. And so it can like kind of like do these like quick little bites that build up a poison hit for the enemies you're attacking. And then it also can do like a big chomp, which is like a consume. And if that takes out, if that kills an enemy, then you consume like a portion of their health as a part of it. But then you can also, switch to the soldier, who's just the big, you know, sort of tanky type. And like, he can do the big sweeping attacks, but he's very slow moving. Like he can't really get around. And so maybe what you're going to want to do is like, you'll come into a fight. You see like seven enemies in front of you. You switch to the slug. The slug, leaves a trail behind itself, and that any enemy that walks over that trail immediately gets hit with a slow attribute. And so you might use one of the upgraded elements you've gotten for the snail that like leaves a huge trail behind, and you also can speed really fast. And so you'll kind of go around the room so that wherever those enemies go, because they're constantly kind of getting kited to you, you're okay, well, they're going to get hit with slow. Then I'm going to switch over to my archer, who has poison arrows and also a rapid fire arrow attack. And as all those enemies get slowed down because of the slime trail I left behind, I'm just going to pummel them with these arrows. And you're balancing that between like these fancier attacks require mana. Well, certain forms are better at acquiring mana faster than others. So like, yeah, the tank dude, he's strong but slow, but maybe you want to use all your fast forms, but you've run out of magic. And so you switch over to the soldier dude, get a couple of whacks in, your magic's back up to top form, immediately switch back over to the different creature that you're playing in. And on top of all of that is there are quests related to the abilities of each of these forms. So it is sometimes it's as simple as do the attack that you have X amount of times. And when you complete that, you'll get XP for your base level nobody character who can't really do very much. But that means like your general health goes up, your Your magic points go up, your base like strength and magic defense stats go up. But you're also unlocking new abilities for the specific form that you're in. So, you know, if the archer is doing poison, it's like, well, if you poison 50 enemies, you complete that, then you kind of like move along the skill tree of that specific form. And so you're kind of bouncing between all these different things. And also as you go through the skill tree of an individual form, eventually you unlock a form beyond that. So there's like a skill tree for the forms, and then there is a character tree that is connected to that. So you like, if it's like, hey, I see that like mermaid, I think that'd be a really cool like form to play around with. Well, I've got to make sure I spend time with this specific other form. And like, it's a game that is almost entirely about a grind, but the way that grind has been conceptualized and implemented is unbelievably satisfying to interact with. It is a game that understands one of the things that I talk about constantly that I like about games is when they force me out of existing habits and like, hey, play differently. We'd really like it if you stopped playing. This one way has become very optimal for you. We're going to stop you from doing that. And this game does that both from, hey, isn't it cool when the bars fill up? Well, you want to see these bars fill up. Well, you've got to play this character in a theoretically suboptimal way, or using a different, a unique strategy. Like the soldier, for instance, one of their skill tree upgrades, like really only happens when you let their health get below a certain amount. So you need to get hit and then engage in combat so that you'll get credit for those attacks and those kills so you can fill up that specific quest. And, that is like goes alongside all these other systems. Like eventually you start interacting with enemies that only have certain weaknesses where it's like, okay, you're going to have to use poison to do any damage. Hey, you're going to have to use sharp or blunt to do any damage. And it's like all that stuff just combines into just a really satisfying action game that has like a fun, goofy, like witty universe, like really cool, art, 2D art style. I'm just finding like after having finished Halo Infinite, a game that towards the end kind of became both a grind and was extremely difficult in a way that I was a little shocked by in a pleasant way. Having this, which is like, hey, I'm kind of a pushover, but like a really enjoyable like pushover is kind of exactly what I was looking for before we get Elden Ring and Dying Light 2, like all these just like big ass like games that are gonna challenge me from their mechanics. Like nobody saves
and from their literary content.
Hey, look, if there are 30, what is the book that they compared
Anna Karenina
to? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stop it.
What? It's working. Item descriptions.
It gets everyone to talk. It gets everybody to talk about it.
That's Nabokov's largest, right? I feel like I saw this was in a crossword recently and I'm dying.
No, I think it's, but it's Tolstoy's, isn't it?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that is the longest one. By the way, I think famously the one with pacing problems, like you were like, the flawed masterpiece. They've really leaned into the like say something really obnoxious about their game and like get everyone to be like, I can't with these fucking people.
I don't think they would have done the. How many words are in our game if people hadn't responded so strongly to it will take you 5,000 hours or whatever it is to like fully beat Dying Light 2. I think they looked at that and kudos to the social person. Like you made the right call. You are not losing sales through this. You're just
negative
getting
engagement,
free PR.
Still engagement.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And there are people who are getting the message. Ooh, game big. Yes.
And there are those
about
people.
It, but game
there
big.
There are lots of those. I am not one of them. I think it's a bad trend in video games, but there are, as I have said on this podcast before, like I have a friend who like game big. Like, cool. That's the game I'll play for the next 9 months. And, yeah. those people
2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And yes. People who have like been playing Skyrim since it came out and that's it. Let's just be glad they didn't say War and Peace, which is almost double the size of Anna Karenina. Apparently, didn't realize that one was bigger.
Kato. Yeah. They have also committed to giving Dying Light 2 5 years of DLC. So I think what we might be expecting in the future is like social person at that studio at Techland. Like, what if you were to make a chart that said over the course of this 5 years, here are the books that we expect to surpass over time with all of the sweet content that we're going to be adding to the game as part of our 5 year commitment to Dying Light.
Yeah, I'm just I am now thinking about like, but also way to call attention to all the other things you could be doing with that time,
like reading Anna Karenina.
I mean, like, let's not go crazy here. But like, you could definitely watch the Bondarchuk War and Peace, huh? That sounds pretty cool. That's like 3 2-hour movies.
That's just text though, right? Which you add, you add the gameplay part of it, like that's not going to be most of those 500 hours technically even. So
right. And Anna Karenina doesn't
you could probably read shit. Anna Karenina like 4 times by the time you played that game.
Someone should make the Anna Karenina that's like, it's like visual novel presentation, but in between chapters, you play a railway simulator. That's to unlock more of the story. Build trains.
You gotta make that train get to that station.
Jesus. Ain't nobody getting crushed by a train until you've used the custom train building interface to create your own locomotives. Anyway, Kato, you said that you had a fun little experience in Valorant.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to give a quick shout out to a person who says they're a Waypoint Plus subscriber, so thanks a lot. I forgot their username actually, but it was very funny because my username in Valorant is just Kato, and they in chat like within the first couple seconds of the game put into all chat a Kato appears ? And I was like, lol, yeah. And they're like, okay, wait, prove it, because I have seen randomly just the name Kato as a popular nickname in Spanish speaking and a bunch of Portuguese people use it, actually, I've found. And so the real funny part for me was like, what can I say that a random person might not say, but someone who, you know, listened to the podcast would remember. So it ended up being, I main Gengar in Pokemon Unite, because nobody plays Gengar in Pokemon Unite. It's one of the least popular characters, but that is my character. And they're like, ah, yes, that's you. That's the Kato I know. But we had a really great match and it was like very close. If y'all want to see though, I did some cool ass shit. You want to see some cool shit in Valorant?
Did you save your dubs?
I did. I mean, I didn't because I wasn't recording, but a friend of mine did. So it is saved for posterity. Here's a link. Copy this link.
Are we gonna know what happens here?
I think thing to understand is that at the beginning, there's four. It's 4v4, and by the end of this match, it's me versus 3 other people. Right, very quickly, most of my team dies here as we're trying to retake this site.
All right, is this going to be your POV? Is it going to be shifting the spectator while you clutch it
out? For the first couple seconds, it's somebody else, and then it stays on my spectator for the rest of it. So,
all right, cool. All right, let's click.
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, go.
1 CT. So now there's only 3 on my team, 2 on my team, 1 on my team. I'm the last person.
Got him right where you want him, Kato. Nice. One.
Get out of my way. This part is heartbreaking, and I'll explain why later.
One enemy. 2.
Gonna come lane, probably.
Do you have to like set these charges throughout? Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have to set the charge to win. I catch that last one with a pick, so their elbow was sticking out behind the box, and I know you can shoot through that box with the gun that I have, and I get it, and it's really good. The second one there, if you don't know Valorant, it's hard to tell what's happening. That person jumped over those boxes and did their ultimate towards me, which is a series of knives that kind of fan out, and they somehow clicked in a way where every single knife missed me. Like, otherwise, I would have been dead. Ouch. I was, yeah, they got the worst roll on those knives, like, flying past me. Otherwise, it would have ended there.
Okay, yeah, I did see the little knife trail animation this time, watching slowly.
Just totally fucked by RNG.
What the fuck were they doing? Yeah.
Yeah, they have this power where, like, that one character has a super high jump, basically. That is one of their abilities, and then a dash. So they jump over the little building there, dash towards me, and then try to throw their ultimate, which is these knives, and just completely whiff. I got super lucky, but that was the round that won it for us. After they had beat us on the defense side, we were, I believe, 4-9, I think is the number that it ended up at the half before it swapped attack and defense. So it was a really, really close game and it was really fun. I feel like their name is in here. This is... Day 2 Nitten, which is the first person I kill in that clip. Sorry about that. They were also in their ultimate, and I just happened to get the perfect angle on them. Shoutouts, Nitten. That was a good game. I'm sorry, I 3v1 clutch your team.
Is Time to Kill really low in this game, or are you just getting headshots really, really quickly here,
low.
I was noticing people were dropping bags of hammers.
It's both, right? It's low, and I got a couple of headshots there that really made it extra fast. But in general, you want one taps.
Yeah.
I am not good enough for one tap, so I tend to hold for three or four, which is when the recoil gets out of control. But yeah, it was just... I did not play the rest of that game that well, but for that one round, I had a really good round, which was fun.
Nice.
This new character... that I mentioned last time. Also, I played her, that blue haired character that I killed early on, has been really fun to play. And just there are certain lanes that people don't check very often because it would take a long time for a normal person to make it up without making noise. Or even if someone's full running, you can hear them coming and then you check that area. With her, her speed is just so much more than anyone else that you could, people are still being surprised by the positions that you can get to. And that's been really fun too. So, Valorant is a good video game still, I think.
When we, launched Waypoint Plus and had that stream, after one of the days of streaming, we went down the street to, or a couple blocks over, me and Rob, to get dinner with Jason Emanuel over at Motherboard, and while waiting outside, mm-hmm. Someone came up and was like, "Cool man, just signed up for Waypoint Plus."
Nice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was seconds before a bartender refused to make my drink order.
Wow.
I believe, if I recall correctly, not just refuse, rolled their eyes at your order.
What was it?
I ordered a Mai Tai. It's a basic tiki cocktail.
Yeah.
Does it involve 8 ingredients? Yes. Mm. There are 8 ingredients that a bar should have in the summer.
Was that place exceptionally busy at the moment? Maybe.
I did enjoy Jason's description of when he came back, where it was the person just rolled their eyes at me and said, "I can't make that."
Honestly, I respect the rejection. I respect the rejection.
I mean, maybe they were out of one of those things.
Well, the thing is, they have a bar, but they're not a bar. That's the real issue too. Yeah.
They're there for beers and the most basic of. Would you vodka and a soda? Cool, we got it.
We got
it.
Yeah, but I get optimistic. I'm like, here I am in the big city. Surely a place as sophisticated as Brooklyn would be able to make this tiki standard, but not for me. So let's see. This week, it's been very rainy and foggy here. And so what better time to get back into finishing up Alan Wake than this week?
I feel like we should have a segment. Okay, we're going to do this going forward, where I want you to do... a vague setup.
Yeah.
Not too specific. You can drop some hints, but then there needs to be
what game do you think I got back into?
Yeah.
Yes. You need to give us You like, we need... someone in the audience, would you like to... If you'd like to make a little jingle, maybe too mellow, if you're thinking of, you know, start doing some brain thinking. Like, I want a moment where we stop and then as a group go, what, okay, based on the information.
You feel like you could have nailed Alan Wake. You
think I wanted a chance to do it like a little
Northwest,
Jeopardy.
Northwest, I feel like I could have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Feel like we could have gotten there as a group.
Yeah, so that's what I've been playing this past week, been having some...
Are you playing the remaster or the original?
Yeah, yeah. Continuing to play on like PlayStation 5. Nice. It's like we just went through like my favorite chapter in the game, Truth, which is the one where Alan wakes up in the yeah, I know, right? He wakes up in the sort of bougie mental hospital that's in Bright Falls, mm-hmm. Being run by Dr. Emil Hartman. And he kind of tries to gaslight you into thinking like all of this has been a dream. And really you just need to get into some, need to get back to your work. You need to get back into doing your writing therapy, and creating for Hartman, who views himself as like, he has no creative impulses, but he believes he'd be a pretty good producer. He could harness people with creative impulses and manipulate them into creating a creative work that fits his vision. But it opens there, which is a really strong location, really like fun cast of characters, even if the level of self-reference is just absurd. Like one of the characters who's completely lost it at that place is, of course, the game designer, who is so put upon by the experience of working on games that they have become completely unmoored. Then, of course, there's the this is sort of what sets up the chapter. You run into the rock musicians who are members of the Poets of the Fall / Old Gods of Asgard, which is the band that pops up in Max Payne 2 and then in Control. But that whole chapter, like, I forgot. I always remember the hospital sequence always stuck out in my mind because, like, it's gorgeous. And it's really cool. It's sort of like it is where the game now finally reveals what's been going on for a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But then you have a really good sequence where once you escape, you are trying to get to the brothers Tor and Odin, who were those musicians, have a farm where they've kept all their like rock and roll shit. And through the power of rock and roll, you can drive back the darkness in this game. But the entire thing is like it's one of those I have missed. Action games that have this arc where it's not very long and it's not, what's the way to put it? It's not just raising the stakes by throwing enemies with more hit points and more like pattern recognition elements at you, like sort of sticking to here's how combat is in this game. Now we will just start letting you play around with like the more advanced weapons, stuff that was like once you want to shoot it once in a level. Now you'll just be like popping it off, like pistol rounds, stuff like that starts to come to the fore in this chapter. But I was sort of struck like, and I think we talked about this a little bit last year, but like, I really enjoy this approach to shooter design. And it feels like such a refreshing break to get back to something like break from the normal right now to go back to something like this, where like the logic of the level is really clear. Like, yeah, it's linear, but also at every turn, like you are reminded of the context for what you're doing and like where it is you're headed. And everything has like a really strongly established sense of relative place. So like, I think there's a point in the level where like over your shoulder, you can see the lodge being consumed by darkness. And then in the distance, you can see the farmhouse that will be your safe haven. And it opens with like a really good pursuit sequence through the hospital where, because of the way the level starts, you are completely disarmed and you don't really have any of the gear you need. Alan Wake always does that. You sort of reset to zero at the start of every chapter. Mm-hmm. But here, it takes them a while to actually give you any good equipment. and you do just for extended periods of that level, you're probably better off booking it than trying to fight it out. And that is that's a fun twist as well, because prior to this, usually you could shoot it out and like win. Here it's starting to play around with the idea that, yeah, maybe you're just going to get overwhelmed. Like, this is a game about these forces of darkness taking over the world unless you stop them. And so, like, at various points, maybe the play is not to try to stand there and take on the entire world of zombies, you know, with just your character. And having that escalate to then sort of the big action set piece, which playing it so soon after Control, it's such a clear precursor in some ways to like the ashtray maze in Control. I think it also, I feel like this comes after Left 4 Dead 2, where you have the big climax of one level being on a like rock and roll stage, like a county fair. I can't remember
I think this is after, because I remember that being like, oh, I'm pretty sure I felt, oh, this feels like Left 4 Dead 2 when I played it in Alan Wake. They're both great sequences, but I believe Alan Wake comes after.
And they're playing around some of the same stuff, right? Like the, you know, the pyrotechnics being things that can sort of keep the enemies at bay, but also occasionally the equipment breaks down and you suddenly like lose the defensive advantage you have from like holding the stage. But like just that whole chapter is such a strong tour de force in like the, I don't know, marking sort of the end of the, you know, second act of Alan Wake or the beginning of the last act. And it's
6 months, 6 months apart, turns out.
Oh, wow. So it was just something in the air.
One of those things. Left 4 Dead 2 is November 2009. Alan Wake is May 2010. So just one of those things.
Well, a lot of game developers, especially of that era, did love them some metal and glam rock. So not surprised that people are like, you know, be awesome is like an old timey rock and roll show, but like in a video game. But yeah, the whole sequence just kind of reminded me of how much I enjoy shooters in this mold, and kind of how much I miss them as well, where it's like at various points they sort of show you the, you know, it's all very classic level design stuff of like, you sort of give people the overview of like what they're going to be navigating in the next section, and then you let them navigate it. But at the same time, that sort of construction and the effects that are possible within it, and always making sure that like there are bounds on the experience and you know broadly where you are located within the level. I am so used to encounters just sort of petering out or having to contemplate like almost MMO aggro radii in them, in the concept of like open world shooters, that going back to something like this was a real breath of fresh air. And I was sort of reminded of like how much I miss this approach to building action games, because it does feel like there just aren't many that operate according to this. Like when I think about like, when have I had seen levels like this laid out, I could only think of like, really, Last of Us 2 is a game that like makes use of that stuff. But even there, it's more of like because that game is so enormous, it's kind of these really exhausting called shots of like, see that aquarium? You're about to spend the next 8 hours of your life walking to this aquarium. And it still doesn't necessarily always like pause and show you like what roughly is the environment you're entering. Like Last of Us often is sort of dumping you in like claustrophobic spaces. But like just playing this, I'm like, this feels like a mode of controlling tension in a game, that I just don't encounter very often. And it doesn't feel like, I think it's very effective, right? I think it's one of those things that like, it's clearly like kind of old fashioned, but I don't think it's like old fashioned way that's been superseded. It's just, it fell out of fashion because it doesn't fit sort of a a dominant paradigm. But like playing it, I'm like, man, I fucking miss shooters like this, man.
Yeah. I mean, I think you still see a lot of Alan Wake and Control. You know, like there is just a feel that is consistent across Max Payne, Alan Wake, Control, that they have altered and changed depending on like the context the games are falling into. But they've never quite shaken that, not clearly on purpose. That's like kind of like a legacy item for how they design things, which makes me all the more curious of, like, you know, the little we know about Alan Wake 2 and taking a, you know, survival, you know, horror sort of direction. Okay, well, what is that? What does that mean? Alan Wake is not a game where you're sweating how many bullets you have. You know, it's a game where it's more about swarm and like there is management systems, like things you're dealing with, but it's not so much about like, I hope I have enough shotgun shells. And that makes me very curious where the moment you start invoking survival horror, well, you're implying that, oh, I'm going to start worrying about the shotgun shells or something in that direction.
It might even end up pushing more that feeling that Rob was saying about sometimes maybe the best option is to run, right? Mm-hmm. If you're running low on ammo and there's a path forward that is more stealthy, or just like you can mitigate the people coming at you in some way, right? That's another way to look at the possibilities they could do that already lend themselves to like some of the things they did in Alan Wake 1.
Yeah, I mean, to some of those points, I do feel like Alan Wake, even that first one, even though I don't really land the, like, it's going to be pretty scary, I think one of the reasons they don't land it is because it feels like a game that's very gun-shy about limiting your access to guns. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. In that last stage of the game, they just begin showering you with all the weapons. And there's probably a few places where the tension would probably be significantly higher if they weren't steadily like injecting you with the most powerful tools in the game.
And so you're saying you're saying it's a survival horror game.
They all break down along these same lines.
Right. Yes. There's like these games, I think, not a game designer, but like having played enough of them, it's like at a certain point you lose track of what the player's doing. Right. Like there's a certain, as the player climbs the mountain of a game that is like has limited resources or is playing in like the horror space, you can like, oh, we know they only have this, have been granted access to Y, and they really could have only reasonably used Z resources. But then you reach a certain point with games of a certain length where that's just no longer possible. And I think that's where they all kind of end up falling. I mean, granted, all horror trends toward action. That is just the mode horror as a genre operates in. But I think that goes hand in hand with the fact that designers essentially have to kind of throw their hands up because they can't account for what players have and haven't done. So they have to go,
Well, it probably gets so much worse just accounting for play styles too, right? Where I am somebody who tends to hoard the good gear to the point where like, I will hit the mid stages of a game and I just have like ridiculous amounts of like the top stuff because I'm afraid to use it, where I'm like, I just, you know, I can get this guy with a pistol. I'm not going to spend a sniper shot to get this character. I'm not going to use, you know, the grenade launcher to take this character down, even though there's probably a designer somewhere being like, and then they'll use the grenade launcher a bunch in this sequence. And then there won't be any more rounds for it. I'll be like, no, I'll carry the grenade launcher through the rest of the game, waiting for the moment to use it. And then at the end of the game, I'll be like, wow, I never did much of that grenade launcher. But yeah, so I've been playing that a bunch. It's been, it's suited the week very, very well. But that's about all I've been playing. I got started on a text parser game called Anchorhead. I think I talked about it a little bit, but I'm still like not sure I'm going to stick with it. It's one of those games that I've seen cited a lot as a great work of interactive fiction. Also like sort of a classic in the space. I'm enjoying it, but also like, man, text adventure. It's a hell of a lift.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you really gotta really carry a lot on your shoulders to sort of make the game go. And repeating steps or like experimenting, it gets maybe borderline excruciating in places. but again, like a decent thing to sort of play on my laptop in between tasks. Anything else I wanted to bring up here before we call it a day?
I can save Halo for Monday. I beat that, but I can save my closing thoughts till next week.
But let the record show.
I did. I finished. Well, no, I did not finish the fight. The fight is not finished at the end of that game.
Whoops! Spoilers.
Oh yeah. They're gonna make more Halo. Whoops! Sorry, I bleeped that part out, Kato.
I also have a pending thing. I started Echoes of the Eye, which I'm already enamored with, but we'll talk.
Yeah, play more of that this weekend, and we can revisit my thoughts on that next week.
All right, so that's a wrap on today's episode of Waypoint Radio. If you want more from Waypoint, you can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint, on Facebook and YouTube at Waypoint Vice. You can follow me at Rob Zachney on Twitter. Patrick, where can people follow you?
At Patrick Klepek.
Kato.
At @A_Kato_appears.
You can also check out what we published on waypoint.vice.com. We published a piece initially around the merger announcement. Patrick and I published a piece sort of covering some of the similar ground to what we discussed today on the pod. And then I am cracking up at this goofus and gallant ass pair of headlines on the site right now. Most game developers are not interested in NFTs and crypto. Game developers are more interested in unions than ever. Also, I don't know if you got to. I see going around Twitter that somewhere somebody tried to push poll where describing like half of gamers love the NFTs and just really want to take part in the NFT market, and then the entire poll was conducted in like an NFT games group or something. and even there, it's like 50% of people like, yeah. So that definitely kind of cracked me up. For our Waypoint Plus listeners, last week we published a podcast on Matrix Resurrections, and this week we are recording an episode of Manhunting on the cult hit crime epic Crime Story. And it turns out we've done such a good job manhunting that we found and captured special guest and diehard Crime Story superfan Jeff Green. If that sounds good, or if you just want more Waypoint, you can go to waypointplus.com and subscribe. Not only do you get access to our premium feed, but you're also helping support Waypoint and especially Waypoint streams, such as the thrilling conclusion?
Question mark?
To House of Ashes, which should be airing maybe as you are downloading this. But we're going to be playing it on Friday if all goes according to plan. So once again, that's waypointplus.com. Our theme music is by Bowen. The track is Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Learn more at waypoint.zone/BOEN. That's us calling it a week. We will talk to you next week. Until then, fuck capitalism. Go home. When my mom was a student teacher, that's when some of this like TV stuff was coming in, and she remembered like, oh, it's like cute. They do like a little morning newscast on the TVs at the school. But you know what's weird is the fact that they run national advertising during
what?
But like the kids are reading the ad copy. They're like doing ad breaks, and it was like for
what?
I want to say like. Kix cereal was running like a get your kicks on Route 66 like jingle marketing campaign, and like the kids are reading ad copy in support of that, and she was like, is this a mock-up or is like somehow the school being paid by like Kix?
Are we receiving ad dollars right now? What's going on?
That is weird. I don't have any memory of that. Not it could have happened. It wouldn't be shocking if I didn't process that information, but Rob Zachney did. That seems that tracks with everything I know about the two of us.
It's like it could have happened. Who knows?
I watched a lot of Channel One. One of the anchors of Channel One went on to become like an actual left the orbit.
Wow.
To become an astronaut. At least they don't leave orbit anymore.
How do I Channel One reporters, anchor alumni, Anderson Cooper?
Wow.
Lisa Ling was the one I was thinking of, though. Does anyone remember Lisa Ling?
No.
I will capture.
I did the anchoring thing once and was not about it, but I loved being behind the scenes and pressing the little lever. Well, you know,
that was always the like the ecosystem of those little like school programs, right? It's like the speech kids wanted to be the casters.
Yep.
And the AV kids were production and tech.
That was me.
Yeah.
There are comments at the bottom of this Channel One anchor alumni.
Oh yeah.
Where is Brian Kilmeade? What?
Kilmeade?
This Kilmeade? Life. Was he
Lisa Ling was on CNN?
Was he on Channel One? He began his career as a correspondent on Channel One News, a daily national high school television news program.
Wow.
Because I think, didn't Lisa Ling turn into a conservative too? That's correct.
I don't know who Lisa Ling. Let me look up Lisa Ling.
I mean, she's on CNN, so it can't be that far, right? I'm saying that far. Far, but not that far.
No, I know what you're making.
I don't know. When is the last time you sat having your tires rotated watching CNN and like just had to sit there for a full hour and be like, wow, this is actually... It pretends to be middle of the road, but it's super not.
Lisa Ling issues, quote, regret statement about her husband's hashtag Democratic whores comment. Updated. What?
See, if she was right wing, she wouldn't have had to apologize.
Well, this quote, I guess it's from Lisa Ling's husband. Now, Secretary Clinton has said that Medicare for All will never happen. Oh, wait, hold on. No. What is this? I'm trying to read this article. Okay. I guess he was a Bernie supporter. Maybe Lisa Ling is not right wing. I don't know. But the comments of this Channel One alumni thing is a lot of people asking, where is Brian from Fox? Like, why isn't he listed here? Too far for Channel One News to.
We just erasing remember. His. Well, he was never here. I never heard of him.
Yeah, no. Who?
Brian. Who?
We didn't give him a start.
Brian. Yeah.
All right. 5 seconds.
No, because I opened a time.is and then closed it.
10 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Patrick did the Dead Island thing and like went forward in time and then backward in time within the same, you know,
right.
Opened the time that is and closed time that is.
I have the same ruthless efficiency to my email inbox as I have to tabs. This is like 30, 40, 50 tab nonsense.
God,
like,
I don't know how many tabs I have currently open.
Get out of here.
That's like, how many tabs I have currently open is like.
Clean up your living room.
In like, theory.
You know what?
Look,
you know what I realized?
What?
I miss like homepages and like having a bunch of bookmarks for like the stuff that like I want to visit that site and see what they're up to. That used to be how I browsed, and now I don't.
It's called Look, one of my the favorites, you know, like the little pin tabs that I have in Chrome. One of those is Feedly. You know what? RSS still lives, baby.
Oh yeah, no. So, but I thought, so I have a fucked up relationship with RSS. I got Feedly and then I delved too deep. I was like, Feedly's going to make it so that I never miss an interesting article. There's so many interesting articles,
there's
dude.
There's a lot of articles.
So it's many. Wild.
There's you gotta so many. Just hit Shift A.
Yep.
That's read all. Uh-huh. And between looking at those headlines and Twitter, I feel like I get enough of what I need to.
God.
So as a Twitter user, I predate bookmarks, and so likes are how I bookmark things, and I keep waiting for somebody to be like, these are some pretty suspect likes, Mr. Zachney, and I'll be like, I'm sorry, I wasn't endorsing that Matt Iglesias piece, I just like bookmarked it 3 years ago so I could read it at some point, and I still haven't, but it seemed interestingly contrarian. Meanwhile, in my bookmarks tab, literally the only bookmark I've ever done on Twitter is alpacas being disturbed and curious about a hedgehog in their midst.
There are bookmarks on Twitter?
Yeah.
See? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you click the little buttons and there's like a bookmark.
I don't know what I would use that for.
But who uses bookmarks when liking is so seamless?
Who goes back and looks at their likes?
I do for bookmarks, Kato. It's a really good like reading list. Like going back to my likes, it's like, damn, look at all these interesting things I didn't read in the last 4 years.
I guess this bookmarks thing would be, I could see it being used like frequently when I'm researching a story. I'm like often bouncing between Twitter accounts and like things people have observed. I could actually see bookmarks being useful for that rather than having like 15 Twitter links in a notes app where I don't know what any of the tweets mean. So like, well, I guess time to open 15 of these to see the one I was looking for. Maybe I just learned something.
Yeah.
Great.
Also, Evernote web clips, pretty good too. Just saying.
Has Evernote paid us yet? I feel like we need to reach out.
I'm not sure they have money to pay people. We'll see what the future holds for Evernote. All right.
Good warm up.
Let me just make sure it's 4:55. Is it 4:55?
It is.
Waypoint.ga. All right.
Is waypoint.ga up?
I didn't have it open, but it is.
It is, yes. 4:55. All right.